Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Hi, my name's Juliet from Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR. We're currently on a break, but have curated some selected highlights from 3CR current affairs content. We are looking at the theme of community campaigns. We hope you enjoyed this summer breakfast special episode, and we look forward to returning to our regular format after our summer break. Happy holidays.
And up next, we're going to be chatting to Kim Chua, a community advocate from the Save Our Community Health campaign. And in late October, it was announced that co-health services across inner city Melbourne would be closing significant aspects of their services due to budget cuts. And at the Collingwood service, this would mean that the pharmacy and counselling services would be cut on 19th of December in just a few weeks. So Kim is here to talk to us about the threat of impending closure and the important supports that CoHealth provides for the community, particularly migrant and public housing communities. But welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Kim.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming on this morning, Kim. We really appreciate you making time to chat to us. Can you start off by introducing yourself and maybe telling us a little bit about your experiences with the Community Health Service?
Yeah, my name is Kim Chua, living in Collingwood Housing Estate nearly 25 years. I'm the co-health community advisor, also Lord Yala Resident Voice Group member, and then I'm the mental health consumer and recovering cancer patient.
Yeah, fantastic. And could you tell us, what does it mean to be a community health advisor?
When the co-health, we meet every bi-monthly, talking about what kind of service we need to provide and how to passing on to the community, how to increasing, how to help the local community, especially in the public housing estate, a lot of new immigrants. And all English is not their first language.
Yeah, and so in terms of, it sounds like the community health services, they're providing a lot of services for the community, particularly people who are living in public housing and who might also be new migrants to Australia. What are some of the specific supports that the community health services offer? Like, would that be translation services and similar offerings like that?
Yeah. All the patients that come to CoHealth, if they can't speak English, we provide interpreter for them. And then CoHealth got a lot of bilingual workers. And, they can try to help in everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's so important when you're accessing healthcare to have, a full understanding of, what the issues are and what support that you need. And so, yeah, it's so important to have people who are bilingual working for these services who can provide that translation to help the community actually understand, what's going on in their medical appointments. And could you talk about what are some of the different services? I know, yeah, you've been very involved in the Collingwood Co-Health service. What are the services that they offer?
Collingwood, they provide not only GP, they have a lot of allied services, like the speech therapy, occupation therapy, acupuncture, all different, what is that, physiotherapy, and then social worker. All of them got all kind of allied services with them. And I want to remind another thing that for health patients, if they can't speak English, they want interpreter. They provide interpreter come with and speak their language with them in the seeing the doctor.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it sounds like CoHealth as well, because they're providing so many services. It's a great place for people to go to access a lot of different healthcare services to support their needs. We've heard recently that there's the risk that the Collingwood CoHealth service will shut down its pharmacy and counselling services. And what impact would that closure have on the community?
Oh, there is a lot. Once they close the pharmacy, I can't imagine how it's going on. A lot of elderly people and a lot of new immigrants that live closer, like the Collingwood Housing Estate, Fitzroy Housing Estate. They just go over there without transport. A lot of young mothers, they can't drive, they don't have car. And we just elderly people. And then I know a lot of Chinese group, elder, other Greek group. I've been living in 25 years. When I seen them, they were 50. Now a lot of them over 90. And
wow.
Then close to 80 to 90. These old patients, I don't know where they will go. They can't walk too far, you know? And once the pharmacy closed in Collingwood, when after you see the doctor, you have to take a taxi to Smith Street to get your prescription and then get your medicine.
Mm.
And that is another cost of living. We have to pay more money again.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and especially because, you know, the CoHealth is, as you're saying, located in the community and people are able to easily access.
That's true.
Yeah, it's so important, particularly, as you said, a lot of people in the community aren't able to drive, so they need to have it close by. And, I think I read as well that the pharmacy provides a lot of the medicines at cost, so it's cheaper than at other pharmacies. So, yeah, it's really important, as you said, with rising costs of living to have these kinds of services.
And especially I want to another mention, most of the CoHealth patients, especially the elderly and the chronic illness patients, a lot of them may take over 4 or 5 prescriptions per day. And then we keep all our prescriptions in the pharmacy, in CoHealth pharmacy, and we don't need to worry about, because every time the doctor gives you the prescription, there will be 4 or 5 times. And then once you did it, the next time you forgot where you put that, especially the elderly people. We always lost our prescription, especially like me.
Mm.
I'm the mental health consumer. I think that I have the electric treatment for so many times.
Mm.
I lost a lot of my memory.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, yeah, it's so important for a lot of the patients like yourself, included, Kim, to, you know, have that continuity in healthcare. it's particularly difficult, as you said, for a lot of older people who've got a lot of different prescriptions. And when you've had all those prescriptions from the one pharmacy, then if it's at risk of closure, it's causing so many problems for the community. What are you hoping joining with the campaign to save community health? What is your group of advocates hoping for in protecting community health?
I wish the government to look to be, you know, our, especially a lot of people living in the public housing. We are the grassroots. We can't afford anymore.
Mm.
You know, cost of living is so expensive. And you, once they're closing down, I don't know where I'm going to see a doctor. A lot of new doctors, they're not both ill.
Yeah.
And then I only got five minutes to see a patient.
Mm.
And for the elderly people, to be honest, sometimes you go to the clinic, you can't explain straight away when you speak. And then we need more, spend more time. And then all the in call help, most of the doctors, we've been seeing them for years, you know. They all understand what we need.
Yeah.
And then if we go to see the new doctor, especially a lot of young doctors, they don't have the time to talk to us. And then you just go in and tell them what, and then they straight away send you out.
Yeah, it really sounds like the existing service at CoHealth in Collingwood is very tailored to suit the needs of the community. And, yeah, as you said, it would be very hard to move to different services. And, yeah, I think it really seems like in this moment when, as you said, it's very hard to find a doctor that bulk bills, we need services like CoHealth more than ever. So, yeah, it really seems... that very important to fight to protect CoHealth when, the community really needs it.
And also, I want to quick explain.
Mm-hmm.
365 CoHealth, and we did a proposed to rebuild as a community health hub.
Mm.
And on the top, we're going to build social housing. And the government been hanging us for nearly 6 years. There's still no response because the Collingwood CoHealth, the property is so old. Interior at the back, all cracked. Last couple of months ago, there was a few days very windy, very heavy rain. And all the workers working in the leaking roof everywhere. So it's unfair for the people working there too.
Mm. Yeah, it's a very difficult situation, and we really wish you all the best, Kim, in your advocacy in the coming weeks. And is there anything that you want to tell our 3CR listeners to finish up of how they can support?
Yeah. I wish if any listener they listen my voice, I hope they can help us to write a letter, email a letter to the local politicians, especially the health minister of the Victoria and federal government.
Mm. Definitely. Yeah.
Help us, please.
Yes, well, we definitely encourage all of our listeners to do that, Kim, and we really want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Goodbye, Kim. Well, we've been speaking to Kim, a community advocate fighting to save community health in Collingwood and inner Melbourne following recent announcements of cuts to CoHealth services across inner Melbourne. 3CR listeners can get involved by writing to their local and federal MPs to fight to save these services.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Jeannie Ersek is a public housing advocate and activist and former resident of the Burrock Beacon Residences in Port Melbourne. And Jeannie's here today to chat about her experience in public housing and the need to protect and defend public housing. And we'll also be chatting about an upcoming documentary, Bay Views for All, which is out later this month. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Jeannie.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. To start off, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and, your experience in public housing?
Well, I have lived in public housing for the past 30 years. I originally lived at the Bank Street Estate, which was all public housing for 24 years. That was demolished, and so I then was moved to Port Melbourne at the Barrack Beacon Estate. I was only there 2 years when I found out it was going to be demolished again to make way for private and community housing. And then I got moved to another house in Port Melbourne.
Yeah, well, it sounds like there's been, unfortunately for you, Jeannie, a lot of moving around. And, I think, you know, that sounds, you know, like a lot of stories we've heard about public housing across the city where, you know, they are, demolishing public housing in favour of building private developments, and as well as, as you're saying, this so-called community housing. But can you start off by telling us a bit about, the Burrack Beacon community and what the public housing was like there?
Well, I was only there 4 years, unfortunately, but it was a wonderful community. I lived just across the road from the beach, so I had the view of the ocean. You could hear the ocean. But it was a great community. There were only 89 units. I knew all my neighbours along the boulevard, that's where I lived, but it was very welcoming. There were no disturbances. My neighbour used to help me out when I had a parcel that I had to collect at the post office. I didn't have a car. He willingly took me. The neighbours were very willing to help you out with anything you wanted.
Yeah, that sounds like a really, tight-knit and, wonderful community, Jeannie. And I know that, back in 2021, the government announced that they were going to demolish the public housing. Could you talk us through, story of what happened there? And was it quite a sudden announcement?
Yes, it was only 13 days before Christmas in 2021 they had come to the door and said that we had to be relocated because the estate was going to be demolished. And that's when I asked them, well, I'd only been there 2 years. Surely if they knew it was going to be demolished, why would they have sent me there to live? And they said they didn't know anything about that. And I said, well, what about community consultation? They didn't know anything about that either. And they didn't know anything about anything, really. All the fact was that I had to move.
That seems like, a very strange decision that, you'd only been there for a couple of years and they didn't know that in advance. It seems like there wasn't a lot of forward planning when it went to organising your housing. And then, after that, the estate was demolished and then you had to move on. And I'm sure that, many other people also, faced a lot of challenges in that demolition. Can you tell us about how some of those stories are coming together in the documentary?
Yes, so in the documentary it focuses on a few people who were the last residents left. I mean, Margaret Kelly was the final resident. She refused to go, so they took her to VCAT, and so she was forcibly removed in August 2 years ago. But there are other residents there that were forced to go as well. They weren't taken to VCAT, but they were made to move. Margaret had two elderly neighbours. One had a stroke. The other one was very sick and old. And they had to move. They really had no consideration for them.
It sounds like, very difficult, especially, for her neighbours who were very elderly to have to move, very suddenly and without much warning. What in terms of the documentary, I'm sure it tells a lot of different stories of the residents of Burrack Beacon. What do you think that kind of the overall message of the documentary is? What can our listeners kind of learn from that documentary?
These are people's homes. They're not just houses that we shouldn't expect just a knock at the door to say that our place is going to be demolished. At least have some community consultation. And if they are to be demolished, at least replace them with public housing and not private housing and community housing.
Yeah, it really seems like, you know, in this situation, particularly I know the title of the documentary is Bay Views for All. So I guess, yeah, there was really this idea that, and, you know, you can let me know if this is right or not, Jeannie, but that yeah. that was really prime real estate and perhaps the government, you know, wanted to profit off that, particular location.
Oh, absolutely. I think so. Because, I mean, my unit faced overlooked the beach, so I could see the beach and I could hear the waves at night. So it was just prime real estate. But I mean, some local people still had the view of the developers that we shouldn't be here, because when it went online that it was going to be redeveloped there, some people had said, well, you shouldn't be living there in the first place.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. I feel like, you know, anyone should be able to live, you know, in that location. That seems, kind of unfair discourse about, you know, who deserves to live where. That's, yeah.
Yes, well, when I lived at Paran, my first offer was the unit at Barrett Beacon. I didn't ask to live at Port Melbourne and I didn't ask to live across the road from the beach. I just asked for a 3-bedroom unit, and that's what I was offered and that's what I accepted.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think, it really goes to show that, you know, with public housing, yeah, you're not the one who's deciding exactly, you know, where the public housing is built or where you're going to live. And, yeah, then you've got a lot of angry people in other parts of the community who don't really understand that and, you know, have these expectations of how the land should be used. In thinking about, I know at the moment there's, the big threat of a lot more public housing being demolished in Melbourne. What are your thoughts on all of this?
They should not be demolished and that they should be redeveloped. I mean, there are so many people on the waiting list. It isn't going to help, and the buildings could be retrofitted and they could save the government millions of dollars, but they have chosen to go through the route of demolishing them all and then having private apartments built and community housing built and no public housing.
Yeah, and for people who might not know, what is the difference between public and community housing?
Public housing is housing owned by the government. The rent, your rent is set at 25% of your income, and basically you can really have it for life. Community housing is run by a not-by-profit company. The rent is sometimes 30%, sometimes higher. You don't have the stability of being able to stay there as long as you can. It's very up in the air as to what your situation is.
Well, yeah, it really seems like, they're really not very comparable. And, as you said, public housing is a lot more stable and long-term, whereas community housing is a much more short-term solution for housing. That isn't giving people that security that they need. Before we finish up, Jeannie, would you be able to point to where our listeners can go, perhaps to if they want to find out more or watch the documentary?
They can go to barrettbeacon.com. And the site will list the film that is showing, The Bay Views for All, on Wednesday the 26th of November.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we definitely encourage people to go and watch the documentary so they can, you know, find out more about the stories of the Barrack Beacon residents and, the story of, that redevelopment and how it really impacted the community. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you coming on and, telling us your story.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. We've been chatting to Jeannie, who's a public housing advocate and former resident at the Barrack Beacon Public Housing, talking about the fight to defend public housing in Port Melbourne and the upcoming documentary Bay Views for All. And you can find out more at barrackbeacon.com. And up next, we're going to listen to a song. This is Christine Anu with her song Island Home.
They're eyeing off an estate which is in perfectly good condition. It just happens to have bay views and a lot of open space.
Bay Views for All is a new documentary that reveals the human cost of the Victorian government's public housing redevelopment project. The film documents residents of the Barrack Beacon public housing estate as they fight to save their homes and community. Bay Views for All is available for community members, public housing advocates, and organisations to screen, intending to spark conversations, raise funds, and educate audiences on the importance of public housing. To organise a screening, email barrackbeacon@gmail.com. That's BARACBEACON @gmail.com.
Save public housing! Stop the damn demolition!
A 3CR supporter.
We are now joined by Kerry Byrne, who is a member of the Save Public Housing Collective and also a long-time public tenant. She has been engaged in issues around the privatisation of the public housing system for many years. And Kerry joins us on the show this morning to talk about the ongoing community pickets to save public housing at 12 Holland Court in Flemington. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Kerry.
Good morning, Fong. Good morning, listeners.
Thank you so much for joining us. So we've talked on 3CR across various different programs about the ongoing fight to save public housing, but you're here specifically to talk about what's happening at 12 Holland Court. So can you start by speaking to us about these community pickets that are taking place? I know that they will be continuing this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in the morning.
That's right. Don't bother going down there today unless you just want to check out the estate. There won't be any pickets today, but it will be happening for the rest of the work week. That's Wednesday to Friday. The morning picket is 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and then the afternoon one is 4:30 to 6:30. And where they're happening is basically on the corner of Racecourse Road and Holland Court. So that's the top end, the north end of the Flemington high-rise public housing estate. And look, if you've got a sign about saving public housing, please bring it along. But I think the organisers have got a few spare signs as well. And look, we know it's hard. People are working and so on. But, you know, even if you can spare half an hour, we don't expect people to stay the entire duration, but just whatever you can manage. Mm-hmm. And there's coffee and tea and so forth.
Yeah. And can you talk a bit about the atmosphere at the pickets? Like, for people who perhaps have never been to one before, what can they expect?
Well, really, it's just a bunch of people holding signs. We get a lot of appreciative toots from the commuters going past, so that's always great. But the other thing is that it's given the organisers more communication, more proximity to the residents inside that particular building. And can I just talk a bit about what's actually going on inside the building at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. Go for it, Kerry.
Yeah, okay. So we've termed it pre-demolition construction zone. So basically, even though there's still one or two handfuls of resident households at 12 Holland Court, there's works going on inside the building. They're drilling and there's other kinds of works going on as well. And I've seen photographs of all of this. So basically, they seem to be fortifying the building so that squatters can't occupy it once the remaining residents have moved out. So I've seen pictures of sort of steel reinforced door frames and elaborate sort of opening and closing mechanisms. So that's what we think's going on. They're spending money on that sort of thing when they can't even fix up broken public housing. You know, there's no money to fix public housing, but there's money to do these very strange Orwellian building works. Mm. So as part of that, you know, obviously it's impacting on the residents. Fortunately, the person who's been documenting all this has some building expertise. So there's been, you know, OH&S incidents, things like power cupboards being left open, but a lot more serious than that, and this is all being documented. And also, a week ago, I think it was Monday last week, the lifts in the building were out for practically the whole day, you know, more than 5 hours. And so, of course, the residents couldn't take their kids to school. It's a 20-story building, bear in mind, right?
Yeah.
And so the residents couldn't take their kids to school. And I also understand that one resident was, they couldn't use their insulin pump for all that time. Until I think Homes Victoria brought them a power bank eventually. So that was another serious incident arising from these works going on inside the building before the residents have left. So if I can just talk a bit more about the impact on residents.
Yeah, definitely. Just quickly, Kerry, it just sounds like it's such a... There's so much dehumanisation going on. Like, I feel like everything that you've described, from the architecture, you know, the what
the building reinforcements or whatever they're building to stop whatever people from doing. Squatting, yeah. But also the fact that, like you said, there's no money or resources being put to support residents there, the fact that the lifts were out, the fact that people couldn't access medical equipment, it's just a very, dehumanizing approach. And it's just something that you keep seeing, right, in terms of there's always money to, for things like weapons and prisons and police, but never any money for community health and well-being. But, please continue with the effects and how this is impacting residents.
Okay. So you may be aware that there was a class action which, unfortunately, the residents lost. They believed that they asserted that Homes Victoria hadn't considered their human rights when they made this decision to demolish the three towers. That's two at Flemington and one at North Melbourne. That class action is the decision of that class action is currently being appealed. And because of that, Homes Victoria formally agreed not to issue notice to vacates until a decision has been handed down. Now, my understanding is that a few residents had received eviction notices, but as I said, they're cancelled now. And I would say, just in case you're wondering, while I don't have personal experience of the people who were handed eviction notices, what I'm aware of is from the Barrack Beacon Port Melbourne estate, when that was all needlessly demolished, the people who were left at the end were there not because they were actively resisting, but because they hadn't been offered suitable properties, right? So I'd say that's why those people were there. And then there were other people in that building we know who have been offered properties that they've accepted, but they're just waiting for those properties to be ready. Now, I want to stress that one of those residents, and I'm personally aware of this incident, 10 days ago, even though this resident had accepted an offer of a specific property and they're just waiting for the property, for the power to be connected to all that, they were actually threatened with having their locks replaced at 12 Holland Court. And obviously this was a major drama and it took, friends and activists quite a long time to negotiate with Homes Victoria before finally in the evening they backed down. That was just, a very weird but obviously very traumatising incident for the resident. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so incredibly stressful. Everything just about this ongoing issue, from the eviction notices or the lack of communication to very extreme measures that you have just described there, which I guess just stresses how important it is to get people down to the pickets this week to stand in solidarity with the residents at 12 Holland Court, Flemington. Before we end the interview today, Kerry, is there anything else you wanted to say just in terms of what we're seeing with public housing across the state?
Yeah, look, Homes Victoria is an entity that's been imposed on the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing. And my understanding is that there are also, bureaucrats or public servants within the department who agree with me that this reckless decision-making will only subside when Homes Victoria is abolished and the business of running public housing goes back within the government firmly. Mm. Homes Victoria has an external board of directors and we don't really know. It's all very opaque, right? We're not really across the advice that the board is giving the minister. And can I just explain the landscape, or are we running out of time? Basically, five towers will be demolished initially. That's the two red brick towers at Carlton, and they're the only two that will be replaced with genuine public housing. So the rest of the 44 towers across Melbourne, well, unless the government makes decision to keep on managing public housing, but so far we think... Well, so far the two at Flemington will, once they're rebuilt, they're going to be rebuilt by the consortium, which is headed up by Community Housing Limited, under the ground lease model, which means that consortium leases the estates from the government for 40 years, and a huge expense. You know, usually when you're a tenant, you pay the landlord, right?
Yep.
But in this case, the government is the landlord, and they're paying the consortium to do the construction. That's fair enough, but also to manage the properties. And we believe that obviously it would be far more effective if it was constructed and managed as public housing. And just finally, those first five towers, two at Flemington, one at North Melbourne, and the two Carlton red brick ones, they'll all be demolished by John Holland, and there's a $100 million contract for that.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Kerry. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I think this definitely warrants another conversation, I think, to go into this in more detail. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast to talk about what's happening in Flemington specifically.
Yeah, and please, everybody, get down to the pickets at 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the morning or 4:30 in the afternoon.
Thanks so much, Kerry.
Cheers, bye.
That was Kerry Byrne from the Save Public Housing Collective. And as Kerry just mentioned, there are pickets running on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday of this week from 7 to 9 a.m. and then from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. For more information, you can follow the group on Instagram at Save Public Housing Collective, or you can visit their website at savepublichousing.com.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush.
The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
It's a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Kill your lawn and kick your fence. A show about how we live in the cities and suburbs and the ideologies behind them.
Fridays every fortnight at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR 855 AM.
From rubbish tip to you.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
So we are now joined by Claire Hansen from the Save Public Housing Collective, who is here to give us an update on the situation concerning the demolition and destruction of public housing towers across Melbourne, the recent parliamentary inquiry, and the upcoming mass rally to save public housing, which is taking place Saturday this week on the 2nd of August. Thank you for joining us today, Claire.
Oh, it's always nice to be invited. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I was wondering if you could sum up what we've seen in the last few weeks regarding pre-demolition works across public towers in Melbourne, as well as the massive response that we've seen from individuals and community groups.
Well, I was a bit gobsmacked myself when I was doing some revision about the parliamentary inquiry, that there are 806 separate submissions from individuals and groups like Safe Public Housing Collective undergoing investigation that, or, you know, being scrutinised as we speak. 806, that's a lot of... what would you say? That's a lot of interest from the public, isn't it? It's not something little quiet little thing going on. And as far as that's their written submissions and public hearings will begin next week, where people will be invited to speak at Parliament House. It's very hard getting answers about where the inquiry is at, because every time we try to, it's all slapped with, we don't have to tell you. Literally, that's how the Homes Victoria won the High Court, the Supreme Court case, class action that was taken by the residents at North Melbourne. They won by saying, we don't have to tell you our feasibility studies and blah, blah, blah. We had to tell them, but they didn't have to show their findings, which is extraordinary, considering those towers belong to us.
Yeah, and we've seen that as a running theme, I think, in the last, in however long this fight's been happening, the lack of transparency and communication from the government and Homes Victoria. I wanted to, go into the parliamentary inquiry a bit. There's been clips, you know, being shared online of public housing residents speaking at the parliamentary inquiry. I was wondering if you could tell us more about the purpose of this inquiry and some of the statements and testimonies that we've seen that have been presented by both residents and lawyers who are representing these residents as well.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not as up to speed as I should be on having looked over everybody's various clips and testimonies. So, but if they are coming from a place in the community that we are coming from, then I can certainly tell you they are about people's, firstly, their right to choose where they live, the fact that they're their homes, they're not houses, these are homes and communities, the fact that the new buildings are appalling and no one wants to live in them. It's a little bit like banging your head against the wall, because they just keep telling us, as though we're dodos, that no, it will be better. We're building better. And they are really not. And we've actually seen that. We've seen the proof of what they're building in place of. And we've provided information, genuine feasibility studies about how the towers in particular, if that's what we're talking about, are perfectly stable. There's absolutely no reason they should come down. As far as action down at the sites go, they have started, when I say they, I'm referring to Homes Victoria. They sent in the cavalry on Saturday morning to take soil samples and were met with people, residents and other concerned citizens, chained to equipment. And I was unable to get down there, but I'm not entirely sure how far they got with their soil sampling, because there was a massive pushback from people down there. It was very crowded. So, I mean, surely that means something to these people who were paid to represent us.
Yeah, well, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like, you were saying at the beginning there that you were gobsmacked at learning how many submissions there were to the inquiry, and just, you know, we've all seen footage of, like you said, people gathering outside public housing in various suburbs across Melbourne, people chaining themselves to equipment. Why do you think we're seeing such a massive response from the broader community when it comes to saving public housing?
That's a good question, and I like it, because those people who, the people who don't live in public housing, are the people who we really want to reach, and they have been pretty good in making their feelings about this known, because I don't think that anyone who doesn't live in public housing thinks much about it, because it's just there. It's just, there's not a person alive who hasn't grown up with the idea of public housing. It's what we do. We're a nice people. We're kind. We put out the safety net. And nobody thinks they're ever going to need that safety net. But I think it's becoming clear to people, that, especially with people living in cars and spending 80% of their entire income on mortgages or rent, I think people are starting to look at public housing now as a genuine, not just safety net, but possible way to go in the future as far as housing generally goes. And, and you know, that's the extreme left of me talking there. But I've lost my train of thought completely, Fawn.
No, that's okay. I think I think I agree. I think you're right in that, you know, perhaps watching the reading about and learning about what's happening with the public housing in Victoria is really resonating with people, because it is sort of symbolic of the issues that people are experiencing at large when it comes to housing insecurity and the rise in rents and mortgages and and even just the pure lack of housing for people. And I listened to your conversation with Annie and Toby on Solidarity Breakfast over the weekend, and you clarified on their show the difference between public and social or community housing. I was wondering if you could share that difference in terms. In these terms for our listeners again this morning.
That's actually a conversation I am constantly having, and it's I don't know if it's slowly sinking in, but there is a difference. We can't use the word social housing because it doesn't mean anything. It's just like saying social security, which is what the dole used to be called. Sorry, what's it called now?
Centrelink.
Centrelink. Social security. So it's just that social housing means nothing. It's just a fluffy word to make people feel better. There are only two types of housing that we support, and that is public and not public. This wishy-washy bit in the middle, community housing, is absolutely evil, and that is what is happening now. Public housing is owned by us. I was about to say the government, but you know, let's get real. The government don't own anything. It's ours. It belongs to the people of Victoria and Australia. And it is run by them, run by the government, managed by the government. They take the rents. They are our landlords, essentially. Community housing, on the other hand, is built by private contractors, are owned by private companies and managed by a third company, sometimes not even in Victoria. Evolve is a New South Wales company that managed the new community builds in Ascot Vale. They're not even in Victoria. How do you manage a place if you're not even here? And they take more rent. They have terrible leases that you have to keep applying for, incidentally. You get leases with end dates. If you get a three-year lease, you have to keep applying, and they can cherry-pick who they put into these places. So being desperate is not a precursor to getting a place in community housing, I beg your pardon. So community is run privately, public is run by us. I think that's the main difference, the only difference.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Claire. I think a lot of the times we see words like social or community and we have hope that it represents or symbolises something that is going to be good for everyone, but so that's why I think it's really important that we that you help us better understand the difference in those terms. My last question for you this morning, Claire, is about the upcoming rally that's taking place on Saturday. You sort of alluded to this before, but why is it important for people to come on Saturday? And we're, you know, talking to people or talking about people who don't necessarily live in public housing or have a direct connection to it. How is this the responsibility of all of us? And not just the people who are personally affected by the demolition?
Well, it's a responsibility of all of us because it's ours. We own it. Mm. You know, I wish there'd been this much pushback when they sold off the water, the public trust, no, sorry, not the water, the electricity, gas and public house, transport. Public transport, now there's a funny word. It's not public. We don't own it. So the reason it's important to attend or show some support is because it is ours. And like so much that is ours, it's being sold off publicly, privately. We are losing everything we own. So the rally is this Saturday, and it's at 11 a.m. And we're meeting outside the State Library on the steps of the State Library, 11 a.m. Saturday, where we will walk to 50 Lonsdale Street, which is the offices of Homes Victoria, and there'll be a few speakers there. And then we will finally end up at the steps of Parliament, where we'll have a couple of pollies who are, you know, fighting the good fight, speaking. And it's really important to have boots on the ground. Getting thumbs up on you know, signing petitions online is just, it means nothing. It means nothing. They barely look at it in Parliament. Thumbs ups mean nothing. Boots on the ground shows solidarity and support. They can't not see boots on the ground. So I would encourage everyone who cares, not just about the people who require public housing, but think about Melbourne's skyline if all of that goes. This will look nothing like the city we all grew up in.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for that, Claire. And, yeah, just for our listeners, we've been speaking to Claire Hansen from the Save Public Housing Collective. You can follow them on Instagram at Save Public Housing Collective.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
Friends of the Earth Food Co-op is open. Get fresh produce and support local farmers and keep our grassroots community thriving through these unusual times. Organic veggie boxes and click and collect now available. Visit www.foefood.org/click-collect to place your orders. Or pop in store at 312 Smith Street and see how we're adapting with our new physical distancing layout. Shop organic and buy local. Made easy at Friends of the Earth. A proud 3CR supporter.
Up next, we have Fleur Taylor from the Save Our Pool campaign in Banyul. This June, Banyul Council voted to close the Olympic Leisure Centre pool in Heidelberg West. And in the lead up to this decision, the community banded together to fight for their aquatic centre and put pressure on the council to reverse the decision. And Fleur is here today to chat about the importance of community pools, particularly in light of National Drowning Day, which occurred last week on July 25th. Thanks for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast, Fleur.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good morning. Well, yeah, we're excited to have you on the show today, Fleur. To start off, can you tell us a little bit about the Olympic Leisure Centre pool in Heidelberg West and what it means to the community?
Well, it's a pool that was, constructed in the 1970s, like a lot of pools around Australia were. And it's a pool that's been subject to a number of community consultations, often facilitated by the council, including a big co-design process that happened sort of over in 2020 to 2022. And time and time again, the community has told the council how important the pool is to them, how important it is to have aquatic facilities that are within walking distance, that have been made culturally safe for a range of different communities in the area. And I think that's what has made the recent decision by the council to close the pool with, you know, like in a really shock sort of decision. So appalling, because it's flying in the face of, you know, really clearly stated community visions and community wishes in the Olympic Village, West Heidelberg area for the leisure centre.
Yeah, that sounds, you know, all very concerning, particularly, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the pool provides so many important community services. Could you speak to some of the programs that the pool offers and, you know, the groups who benefit from them?
Well, it has aqua aerobics sessions, and a hydrotherapy space where people who are recovering from injury or perhaps are elderly or needing to sort of maintain physical fitness or recover from injury in different ways access. It also has, you know, just a regular swimming pool, and it has a gym there as well. One of the sticking points for the community has been that it used to have like a kids pool, but that's been sort of closed off for years. And I guess there's a concern that, you know, despite multiple reports going to the council over dating back, you know, more than a decade, like detailing the amount of, like, you know, support and repair needed to maintain the pool to an acceptable standard and maintain it as a community facility, it has been allowed to run down. I think one of the most noteworthy things that the pool currently offers, which currently has no alternative offered yet by the council, is that it has a women's only session on Friday nights, which isn't just about swimming. It's about social, physical and mental health. It's, you know, widely used by Muslim women in the community and from beyond the Banyul community, for a women's only space where people, you know, use the sauna, use the hydrotherapy pool, swim, use the gym, but also connect with each other at a social level, you know, away from the kids, away from the pressures of daily life. And that's probably one of the most distressing things about, you know, this sudden decision to close the pool, which is, you know, currently slated for October.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, that point about the pool being, you know, more than just a place for physical activity, but for, you know, maintaining the social and mental well-being of the community. There are, you know, so many important aspects that the pool provides. And, I was reading about how, you know, some of the reasons that they've posed for closing the pool was about the numbers of people attending. And, yeah, it does sound like with the children's pool being closed for a long time, that would really limit the user groups who can actually use the pool and what sort of programs can be run.
Well, I think as well that you know, I mean, as we all know, like, statistics can be sort of cut many different ways, can't they? And so, you know, if they only survey people who have a membership that's based at that pool, you know, they might not be catching all the people who use it regularly but don't have a membership, or have a membership, you know, that's based at another aquatic centre but allows them to use this facility, you know, or people who use it, you know, casually but are not sort of registered there and so forth. But I think, you know, your point is valid as well, that, like, if you make a facility sort of harder to use and don't put the funding into it, and I think, you know, the West Heidelberg community is, you know, unfortunately seeing that happen in a lot of, you know, different spaces, you know, in this area, you know, then you kind of bring about the sort of, you know, the outcome that that you were angling for anyway. And
I think
that's the issue where we feel like the more that we dig, the more that we sort of ask questions at council, the more that we talk to local residents, the more that we go around with our petitions and you know, talk to people, like the more it comes out about, you know, the broken promises and the mismanagement and the sort of mixed messages that people have been getting about this facility and other facilities.
Yeah, definitely. So last week was National Drowning Day. Could you speak a little bit, Fleur, as to, you know, why having a pool is really important in relation to, you know, community safety and drownings?
Yeah, well, I mean, as listeners would be aware, there's been a surge in fatal drownings in Australia over the last few summers and at other times during the year. And it is noteworthy that some of these, you know, that many of the people that have tragically drowned have been from migrant communities or communities where, you know, learning to swim or having those swimming skills from childhood hasn't been, you know, something that's been part of their culture in the same way as it has if you've grown up from a kid here in Australia. And so given that West Heidelberg area has something like 46% of households where both families are from, born overseas, and particularly we also have in our community almost double the number of households that don't have a car compared to the rest of Banyul. So having a facility where people can learn to swim, where people can be safely in the water, you know, within walking distance of their homes is critically important. And so, like, our key focus at the moment is, you know, that we object to the council closing this pool with so little notice and so little voice for the community. A whole group of women came to speak at the last council meeting and were, you know, basically shut out of the process. They wanted to share their experiences of how important the Friday night swimming is for them. And so our key demand at the moment is that the council has to slow down this process. You know, maybe it is the case that the swimming pool was too far gone and something else, you know, needs to be built to accommodate the needs of this community. But at the very least, they need to, like, why would you close a pool in the face of rising drowning rates and all of the issues that we've mentioned? Why would you close a pool before summer? Wouldn't you keep it open, you know, for at least one more summer and let people have that that ability and properly consult with people about what the future is of aquatic facilities in West Heidelberg?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you've spoken, Fleur, about what some of those demands are that the community has. What are the steps that the campaign's going to be taking in the months ahead to continue to put that pressure on?
We're going to be attending and protesting outside and asking questions inside every single council meeting, you know, until further notice, until we get action on these points. So the next council meeting is to be held at the Heidelberg Town Hall, which is in Upper Heidelberg Road, Ivanhoe, on Monday the 4th of August. So our rally will take place from 6 p.m. And then we will attend the council meeting and, you know, probe further into the issues via our right, our democratic right to ask questions of our elected representatives from 7 o'clock onwards. Every Saturday from 11 o'clock, we're outside the Olympic Leisure Centre itself, which can be found on Southern Road in West Heidelberg, and you can come and join us there and, you know, especially call out to anyone who's the resident of Banyul and or a user of the Olympic Leisure Centre pool to come and join us in the campaign and look for our group on Facebook, Save Our Pool 3081.
Yeah, awesome. Well, that's actually exactly what I was going to ask you, was how our listeners can find out more. So really appreciate you sharing all of that, Fleur. And, thanks so much for coming on and chatting about, you know, the importance of your community pool and, you know, what you're doing to fight for it.
Thank you very much for having us on, and all strength to the many other campaigns that are taking place, you know, across Victoria and nationally to save infrastructure like pools. We know we're just one of many communities that is facing these issues.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Fleur. And, we've been speaking to Fleur Taylor from the Save Our Pool campaign about the community effort to reverse the decision to close the Olympic Leisure Centre pool in Heidelberg West. And we also spoke about the importance of community aquatic centres.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au, that's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinina. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jar Jar Rong, Kalkadoon, and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
Up next, we are speaking to Nina, who is the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator at Flat Out. And Flat Out is a community-based organisation focused on helping women and gender diverse people to get out and stay out of prison. And Nina's here to chat about Flat Out's work, how they engage survivors who've experienced incarceration, and Flat Out's recent presentation in Alice Springs, Mabantwa, about economic reintegration. Welcome to 3CR, Nina.
Hi, how you going?
Yeah, good, thanks. Thanks so much for getting up early to chat to us, Nina. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and, you know, how you came to be working for Flat Out?
Yeah, sure. First, I'll just acknowledge that I am on the lands of the Bunurong people of the Eastern Kulin Nations in a place called Malau, which is otherwise known as Phillip Island, and that it always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Yeah, so my name's Nina. I'm the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator at Flat Out. I've been there for about 3 years and was working as a lived experience advocate across the sector, predominantly in the justice space and family violence space because of my lived experience. So I'm formerly incarcerated and also a survivor of intimate partner violence and also of state violence. And I just want to make that really clear because a lot of the time we look at prisons and, you know, the narrative is that they provide safety for community, but they're actually really, really violent places and warehouse bodies and are places of torture. And there are heaps better alternatives to prisons. I was one of the folks that were incarcerated because of the last bail laws.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I was suffering a drug addiction and also was experiencing family violence. And so I would have, it would have been a lot more beneficial for myself, for community, for my loved ones, for my children and for my family if I had gotten support for the family violence that I was experiencing and also for the substance use that I was using to self-medicate and gain some distance from myself and be able to detach from my current experience. I actually think that the drug use is what kept me alive during my family violence experience. And, yeah, I just see consistently that policing is stealing money from our communities. We spend so much money in Victoria in our prison industrial complex And it's very clear that they don't work, because if they did work and did deter people from doing things or provided a place and space of rehabilitation, they would actually be empty. And considering that, you know, they're building new prisons consistently and the crime rates are actually going down, if you have a look at the statistics, it's just the narrative that gets pushed. Our crime rates are down, yet we're increasing prisons because we do things like demolish the public housing towers and, you know, there's such a huge housing crisis and people are in poverty, and the people that are in poverty or experiencing housing insecurity will often be targeted and end up incarcerated because they've got, you know, multifaceted other sorts of things happening in their lives. And, yeah, so our prison systems aren't solving social issues. We need to start focusing on social issues and supporting people's needs rather than seeing them as high risk.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, yeah, that whole, you know, there's so much need to actually be talking, you know, to people like yourself, Nina, who can speak to, you know, how this, yeah, as you said, is a prison industrial complex. It's not actually rehabilitating people, you know. As you said, crime rates are actually going down, and you know, we really need to actually focus on you know, other alternatives to actually helping people you know, who are facing family violence and so many other you know, challenges as well. But can you talk a little bit to us about, you know, what the aims of the Family Violence Justice Project is, and, you know, how the project engages with people who've experienced incarceration?
Sure. So FLAIR is an organisation that supports trans women, gender diverse folks across Victoria in the prison system, and we also support their children with a variety of different issues. Like, we know there's, you know, lots of intersecting things: family violence, mental health, housing, AOD. And we really provide, and, you know, these sorts of terms are thrown around consistently, like person-centred, trauma-informed, holistic. and sort of, for me, they sort of tend to lose their meaning because it sort of becomes this tick box. And, you know, people say that that's their practice. However, in reality, that's not actually what's happening on the ground. And so formerly incarcerated women find it really hard to engage with services because of systemic collusion. And what that means is, for instance, if a victim survivor presents to a mainstream service and indicates that there's alcohol and other drug use in the home, child protection will be called and the children will be removed. And not only is she then experiencing the family violence, but the violence will escalate because the person who's using violence will blame her for having the child removed. She will feel hugely more traumatised because she's had the children removed. And it just pertains to an infuriating, massive, dangerous situation. And so what we do is we really have a look at the person and we assess their needs and really try and support them through what they're going through. And the Family Violence Justice Project was designed because of the Royal Commission into Family Violence. One of the findings was that criminalised women are one of the highest marginalised groups that experience violence, however, are the least likely to engage in mainstream services because of those reasons. So we provide a lot of training and capacity building in the sector around misidentification, resisting systemic collusion, the intersections between child protection and criminalisation, alcohol and other drugs. And we sort of just give a really good oversight on how people can start seeing people for how they're presenting as high needs rather than high risk, and get them the support that they need.
Yeah.
And also at Flat Out, we are very, very lucky and very fortunate. I mean, you know, you hear the term "nothing about us without us" across the sector, and it started in the disability sector. And we're really, really true to that. So we've got lived experience, formerly incarcerated lived experience folks at the board level, and we also have them embedded as advisors or consultants across all of the different programs. So we're really led by who we're trying to serve. And so there's also I founded a collective called FIGJAM, which stands for Former Incarcerated Girls Justice Advocates Melbourne, but also has a double meaning, which folks probably know, and it starts with the F word. F, I'm good, just ask me.
Yeah.
Because of that shame and discrimination and all of those sort of nuances that are pushed into us continuously as being criminalised, we really wanted to also unpack that and shed a bit of light and also have a bit of a laugh, you know? It's not, you know, just to not always be so serious. And so there's probably about 30 members in that collective, 15 really active members. They meet weekly. There's a number of different projects that we work on alongside universities. We embed our expertise in research, do consultancy, presentations. And the women really, really sort of drive the work. And so there's two components of that. One is the work element and the other one is the peer support, because it's really hard for criminalised folks to find community when they're released.
Mm.
Because we move so much in the shadows and keep each other safe in community, if you're not connected to that community, it's hard to find other people who are in community that have been formerly incarcerated. And so we also provide a point of connection when people are released.
Yeah, that's so important. And, you know, creating that sense of community and having people, you know, that people can relate to and, you know, have that sense of, community and solidarity with. And you touched on, Nina, that, you know, FIGJAM gives presentations, and I know that recently you travelled to Alice Springs, Mabantua, with FIGJAM at the Reintegration Puzzle Conference. But can you tell us a little bit about that presentation, maybe some of the key points or takeaways from it?
Yeah, and I just also want to touch on just that I've been to a number of different conferences Australia-wide, and the Reintegration Puzzle Conference really focuses and elevates lived experience folks. So it's a two-day conference. However, on the very first day prior to that conference even taking place, they put on a lived experience lunch. And so all of the lived experience people that are either attendees or presenting, they all get to meet one another. So you never get lost in the crowd. And I think that that's really, really important, because as a lived experience person, the divide between lived experience and professionalism is still very real.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a place to come together and meet and greet really builds that relationships, that connection and that networking. And then there's we had a cultural workshop followed by an all-in dinner where then everybody attends. And it was just a really, really beautiful way to kick off. And so we went along the FIGJAM Collective. There was 11 of us. That went along. A lot of the folks were on parole, so that normally means that you can't leave the state. However, because of the safety and the work that we're doing and because of the positive relationship that we've started building with parole, it was really easy to get the women to be able to come along, which obviously also speaks volumes, because parole can be really, really challenging for some of the women. And a lot of stipulations and conditions are placed on the women, trans and gender diverse folks, when they are reintegrating into community. So that was a huge win in itself. Mm. And so we had a 40-minute slot, and we really spoke about how lived experience translates into professionalism and sort of all of the things that we've been doing to lead us up to where we are today, upskilling folks, what sort of engagements people have done. And so there was 5 women on the panel, and they each spoke to their journeys while being connected to FIGJAM.
Yeah, that sounds really wonderful, and, you know, such an amazing opportunity as well, Nina, that, you know, you were able to bring together that group of women and, you know, give them, yeah, that opportunity to you know, participate in community and, you know, make those connections at that professional level as well. But, yeah, before we wrap up, can you tell us a little bit maybe how 3CR listeners can find out more about Flat Out's work and get involved?
Yes. So Flat Out have got a membership, and they also have a newsletter, which is awesome. It's so good. It's so we've only been running it for I'm not even going to say that right. Maybe like we've started it within the year, but it's got great content on it. Obviously, we've got socials. Jump on the Flat Out Facebook, Instagram. Yep, subscribe to the newsletter. You know, give us a couple of donations because we don't get money from corrections, because if we did get money from corrections, it would actually hinder the sort of support that we try and give the women. And so, yeah, please donate. And what was the other question? Sorry.
I guess just how people can find out more and get involved.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, there's a number of different sort of we've done the Homes Not Prisons podcast series with 3CR.
Mm.
We've also done the Untold Stories of Injustice with 3CR that was Fig Jam led. I can't say enough about 3CR. Like, it's such a beautiful Aww. Platform. Another Fig Jam was actually interviewed yesterday.
Yeah.
It's just we are really, really fortunate to be able to spread our message and for you to allow our voices to be heard on radio, because I think so many different marginalised communities, like when you hear their experiences, that's how we connect and that's how we relate and that's how we change that stigma and discrimination. So, yeah, just want to say really appreciate you for asking me to be on the show this morning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, we really appreciate you coming on, Nina. And, I think it's so important to, you know, be changing the narrative and actually getting people to speak about their own experiences, you know, to really challenge what we do here in the mainstream so often.
Beautiful. Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You too. We've been speaking to Nina, who's the Family Violence Justice Project Coordinator at Flat Out, about the intersection of family violence and women and gender diverse people who've been incarcerated and the organisation's work in helping women and gender diverse people reintegrate access community after prison. And you can follow flatout.inc on Instagram for more information.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you're currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Have you heard about the news that's come out of the NT?
What news? Fires, floods, chicken flu, what?
No, the payouts.
Payouts?
Compensation for what you went through.
No.
Well, I reckon you should go for it. You deserve every cent and more. I'll back you. You know it.
Oh, sis, you're the best.
Yes, I am.
If you are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander and were removed from family or community in the Northern Territory before 1 July 1978 or in the ACT or Jervis Bay before 11th of May 1989, you may be eligible for the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme. If you know of a family member who was removed but passed away after the scheme was announced on the 5th of August 2001, you may be eligible to apply for redress for them. Call Link Up Victoria, VACA, on 037 002 3700 and leave a message for a callback or contact the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme on 1800 566 111.
A 3CR supporter.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Take control of your own breast health so you can stay strong and healthy for yourself, your family and community. If you are a woman or trans and gender diverse person aged 40 to 74 with no breast symptoms, you can have a free breast screen every 2 years. Breast screens with us take 10 minutes, are with a woman radiographer, and you can bring someone for support or organise a group booking. Don't just screen for tomorrow, screen for life. Book at breastscreen.org.au or call 132050.
A 3CR supporter.
We hope you enjoyed our 3CR Breakfast Summer Special focusing on the theme of community campaigns and featuring highlights from our current affairs programming across 2025. We look forward to returning to our regular programming after this summer break. And until then, don't forget to stay tuned to 3CR Community Radio on 855 AM.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.